the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true. I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World, live at 5 p.m. Pacific time here in Las Vegas, Nevada. The day after Christmas, and for me and you, our best Christmas gift is a day late, and you'll hear him very, very shortly. As a former comic, as Frank Sinatra said, I absolutely hate puns. They are the lowest form of humor. They are punishing. But I'm going to inflict one on you because I just wrote it, and as punishing as it is, I happen to like it. It only takes a minute to get to the punchline, if there is a punchline. From my childhood to my years in school and movies and to this day, I have been aware that my life and my country have been built on nothing but myths. Joseph Campbell wrote about it, the power of myth, beginning with Christmas and Santa Claus. What are we actually celebrating this holiday? We're celebrating the appearance of an overweight, unshaven fellow with a W.C. Fields complexion, an ill-fitting red suit who only works one day a year, December 25th, the fake birthday of a long-dead, short-lived, unemployed carpenter and part-time preacher whose real name was Joshua Ben Joseph. His brother's name was James. And he's carrying around this endless sack of toys purchased on credit by financially strapped parents for kids who may or may not deserve them. And he makes this overnight trip around the Western Hemisphere in 15,000 miles, okay, one night. And that, the mode of speed of light transportation, is a sled pulled by 8 gravity-defying flying reindeer, and that all of this is accomplished without one of these 8 reindeer dropping his lunch on one house. That is why people who believe this believe there will one day be peace on Earth. Now let's go to the movies. You will see right after the first of the year in the American media and the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy, which is part 2 of the Garrison tapes, that New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison did indeed solve the case in 1967, but was sabotaged by the media's and CIA's and government's Project Mockingbird. When I asked Mr. Garrison why he ever thought he could take on the government, he chuckled and he said, quote, "John, I guess as a kid, I saw one too many Frank Capra movies," unquote. Now to history and religion. Christopher Columbus, lost looking for China, is saved by savages in the Caribbean. He teaches them the values of Christianity and private property by chopping off a few hands. And after this last election with 2 candidates who would have to improve just to be dreadful, the continuing myth of democracy in America. Now here's the pun. Anybody believing this last, most important myth about democracy at the polls is making a terrible mistake. Oh, jeez. That is god-awful, but I really do like it. Mistake. Anyway, now from the ridiculous to the sublime, which means from me to undoubtedly the smartest man in America who dismantles these myths more brilliantly than any critic or political pundit in this country. In such best-selling books, all of which I have, books like War, the Force That Gives Us Meaning, Empire of Illusion, this one I like the best, I think, Death of the Liberal Class, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. We are witnessing the days of destruction. But in his newest semi-autobiographical book, which is a fantastic, thrilling, easy read. It's called Unspeakable. In a fabulous conversation with David Talbot, he tells how he became who he is, thankfully for us, and how and when this revolt will begin. Back for his second wonderful, enlightening visit, Chris Hedges. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show. It's an absolute pleasure and delight to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, one of the things in your book that made me feel a little bit sad is talking about your career with David, that you seldom saw your family. I hope you happen to see them over the holidays.
I don't travel anymore. Yeah, for 20 years, that's all I did.
Well, you had it. Did you have a terrific holiday?
Yes, very quiet. Great.
Wonderful. Why did? How did the idea of sitting? But I love your books, and one thing that I like to know when I read people or I see people whom I admire a great deal, I like to know how and why they became who they are, and what made you sit down with David Talbot? How did this all come about for The Unspeakable?
Well, that was David's idea. He proposed it, and David, of course, is quite a formidable journalist in his own right, an author, and somebody I respect. And as you know, the quality of interviews is so much determined by the interviewer. And I immediately agreed, and we taped many hours and did transcripts. And not surprisingly, the questions he asked were questions that not a lot of other people would have asked. Some of those questions no one's ever asked me. And, because of his direction and guidance and, the weight of his own intelligence, I thought it was interesting. It was an interesting book, and I was happy to do it.
Well, I had no idea, Chris, when it showed up. I thought it was going to be another one of your wonderful essays about something that's going on, because it had the word unspeakable in it, which is like, of course, that wonderful John Kennedy book called The Unspeakable. So I thought it was somehow related to that. I read it twice. I started reading it in the morning. I finished reading it at night, and then I reread it the next day because it was just the first part is so moving and so emotionally informative, and then the second part is so intellectually rewarding. So I would have to start out by asking you the first question that David asked you, but adding a little addendum to that. His first question was, what made you a radical? And Chris, are you a radical? Do you think of yourself as a radical? Or are you what you partially described in Unspeakable, an anarchist?
I'm not an anarchist politically. I'm an anarchist individually, in the sense that I will never, as a writer, serve any system of power. Am I a radical? Yeah, I think so. I think a radical is somebody who will hold fast to a particular belief system or moral imperatives, no matter what happens. In that sense, Martin Luther King was a radical. Malcolm X was a radical. They were just never going to be swayed by the practical. I very much identify with figures like that, that it doesn't really matter to me whether one is, at least in the eyes of the world, successful. One stands firm around one's beliefs and fights for what one cares about. And I think much of that comes out of being a war correspondent. 5 years in El Salvador, 3 years in the Balkans, 7 years in the Middle East, where many of the people I worked with, not to mention many of the people I covered, fell victim to violence, and you would take great risks to get a story, to report on massacres that had been carried out in El Salvador, Serbs had carried out, and you knew you'd get up tomorrow and they'd carried out more massacres, but you took those risks anyway.
you saw that as an adult, though, but radical philosophy probably would have been something that you would have experienced in your own household, your mother, your father.
Right. Well, my father was a huge influence. He was a Presbyterian minister. He had been a sergeant in North Africa in World War II, a very outspoken critic against the Vietnam War, and took me as a boy to anti-war demonstrations. We lived in an all-white farm town of less than 2,000 people in upstate New York. He stood up for the civil rights movement, very unpopular position in rural white enclaves where Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. And then he stood up for gay rights. His brother, his youngest brother, was gay, which finally got him pushed out of the church. And so, yeah, he was a huge influence. And he taught me many important lessons, one of which is that you're not going to be rewarded, even by the institution you serve, for doing what is right. You'll often be punished. And I think that understanding served me very well in life. I was never disillusioned.
The stories about your father and your mother were very moving, but you had an opportunity that it's not open to, because obviously you were not from wealth. You probably were middle class, as everybody was probably in the 50s, middle class. So, but you had an opportunity to go to school at an elite school.
Yes, I got a scholarship at the age of 10 to go to a boarding school. And I was one of 16 kids on scholarship. So I grew up around the uber rich. And that, I wouldn't send any child to a boarding school at 10. But it certainly taught me about the 1%. It taught me about the elites. I was in their homes. I watched boys 10, 11, 12 years old order around adults, i.e. their servants, their nannies, their chauffeurs, their cooks. I saw that inner world, which is really deeply repugnant. And
what were some of the names of the people with whom you went to school?
The Buckleys, the Scrantons, the Bissell family ran the CIA, King Hussein's two sons, Kirk Douglas's kids. They were all there.
Well, was there anyone else at the school in your economic class that you obviously weren't swayed or impressed? Actually, you seem to be terribly turned off by the personalities and beliefs of these people. Was there anyone else you knew who was the same economic class as you who went along with?
I think most scholarship kids, when they go to these elite schools, emulate the rich and seek to become like them. And they're given a kind of passport into that world if they want to use it. So my feeling is that probably most of them, didn't necessarily follow their careers as adults and what happened to them, but my feeling is probably most of them. Yeah, I think that I had this schizophrenic, my mother's family was from Maine and were all lower working class, and I would go back. My grandfather had to leave high school, his last year in high school, because his sister's brother had died, and he had to go work the farm and to feed the kids. And very bright, but he never had an education. And I would come back to that town in Maine and realize that I had relatives that were intellectually not only equal, but probably superior to most of my classmates, but they'd never been given a chance. And that was important for me. It kept me grounded, and it allowed me always to know who I was and whose side I was on.
Did you wish to be a preacher like your father?
I wished to be always a writer. I always wrote, even as a young boy, poems and short stories. I published my first piece in a historical journal when I was about 12 or 13, published my first piece in a major newspaper in the Christian Science Monitor when I was in college. But I couldn't reconcile that supposed objectivity or neutrality of American journalism with the fierce commitment to social justice that came out of my family, and in particular my father. And so I went to divinity school to be a preacher like my dad. I was going to be an inner-city preacher and lived in across the street from a housing project in Roxbury, and then kind of broke with – I went to Harvard, broke with the liberal church and liberal institutions like that. And but yeah, I think that influence was one that certainly sent me forward until I kind of did what I should do, which is write. And then I left after divinity school to go cover the war in El Salvador.
The thing that really surprised me the most was to read that at one time you wanted to be a cop.
Right. So I did 2 years of divinity school, and I'd had enough of the church, you know, all those people who liked the poor but didn't like the smell of the poor. And I wanted to stay in the inner city, and so I took the civil service exam to be a cop, because we had a few good cops, and I saw what good cops could do. One in particular, he lived in the neighborhood. He was white. His wife was black. He cared about the neighborhood, and I scored very well on the test, but it later came out the mayor was Kevin White. Under his FBI indictment, there were 50 spots, and he had given 48 to, you know, cronies and patriotism, people in South Boston. It was completely fixed. I mean, I ended up going studying Spanish in South America with the Mary Knoll Fathers, coming back, finished my degree, and then going to El Salvador. But yeah, I did.
When you went to El Salvador, did you have any idea of what you were getting into? Did you have any idea that what you would observe and write about would ever be printed anywhere?
Yeah, I had freelanced. So in my year off, I had published pieces living in South America in the Washington Post. I had been in Buenos Aires during the Falkland War and covered it for NPR out of Buenos Aires. So in that year, I'd actually done quite a bit of journalism. I'd written for the Baltimore Sun, Yorkshire Post in England, and had enough out of that year to be able to actually sign a 3-month contract as a freelancer with the Christian Science Monitor. So I did go down there and immediately began writing as a freelancer, yeah.
One of the things that impressed me the most also, aside from the fact that you obviously you attack the right-wing fascists who are running these countries, but also you take on a number of the leftists too, which was quite impressive. I mean, it demonstrated a real individuality in your view of the world.
Well, I didn't ever believe that lying, and the lie of omission is still a lie, on behalf of anyone or any cause was morally defensible. And I saw the left, which could be quite fierce, and I think rightly so, in its critique of the military-run government in El Salvador and the death squads, would then go to Nicaragua, where the human rights abuses under the Sandinistas did not begin to compare to what was happening in Guatemala and El Salvador. But nevertheless, people knelt at the feet of the comandantes, and it kind of disgusted me. And I was angry in the sense that it destroyed the credibility of the left. Because what they were saying about El Salvador, what they were saying about Guatemala under Rios Montt was true. But by going limp, in essence, in Nicaragua and wanting to be validated by the Sandinista government, they destroyed whatever credibility they had. And I felt that was deeply counterproductive and deeply dishonest, and was quite vocal about it.
Was it your articles with the Christian Science Monitor that got you with the New York Times? And then let me add this little bit to this question about the New York Times. The New York Times has always been a strong supporter of empire, all the way from Iran to El Salvador, Guatemala, Chile. Why would they have hired someone who seemed to have your anti-establishment point of view, do you think?
Well, because I consciously placed myself in situations where the people around me were enduring tremendous oppression, which often meant a certain amount of danger. And when I was hired by the New York Times, I was in the Middle East, and was working for the Dallas Morning News, and I had taken a sabbatical before I went to study Arabic. So I was in places like Gaza, and the paper wanted, number one, somebody who had some language facility, but also somebody who was willing to go into these places, which not a lot of people are willing to do. So I remember when I told the executive editor of the New York Times that I wanted to go to Sarajevo during the war, he said, the line starts and ends with you. In fact, Sarajevo was so dangerous that the bureau heads all throughout Europe had signed a joint letter saying they wouldn't even go anymore. So the competition for the kinds of assignments I wanted was not particularly high, and in some cases I didn't have any competition at all.
Did you ever get the feeling when you were at the New York Times that the New York Times was not publishing for Americans in general, but probably for the 1% who owned the country? And tell me a little bit about, there were many talented people who obviously came across at the New York Times who just didn't seem to fully express the talents that they had or make the observations they had. Tell me about some of your coworkers.
Well, that's true. I mean, the New York Times is written. I mean, they have targeted, in fact, the top sort of 30 million Americans they've defined as the elite. And I'm not, that's not a number I'm guessing at. That is the number. Yes, it is an elitist organization. And it's very difficult when you're in the Washington Bureau or even in the New York Bureau because you have to cater to the power elite. You need to have access to those elites. Otherwise, the paper is angry at you. It's very different when you're in Sarajevo or when you're in Gaza. It gives you a kind of freedom to report that you don't have when you're close to the epicenters of power, when you have to have lunch with these people. I did a lot of kind of very basic war reporting where I was getting numbers of people who were killed, of, you know, people who were wounded and killed in a shelling, you know, attacks. I mean, it was a kind of mostly daily journalism that required verification under great difficulty. 60% of your time could just be spent trying to get to the story. And I felt that that was important, and I felt that it was worth the risks that I was taking because a lot of people wouldn't take it. And it gave me a niche in the paper by which I felt that I could maintain my own integrity and yet work for the New York Times at the same time. But yes, you are very right. It is a paper that really doesn't care not only about the working men and women, but even about the middle class. And you can see that only about 15% of the New York Times is news, and the rest of it is style and home and living and fashion. And
your reporting won you or co-won you a Pulitzer Prize, and then at the same time you sort of denigrate the Pulitzer Prize and the way it's won, and you seem to indicate that the New York Times is what runs the Pulitzer Committee.
Well, maybe better now, but they certainly have tremendous influence, and that's why, if you especially go back to when I was at the paper, they were disproportionately showered with Pulitzers. Yeah, the Sulzberger family and the New York Times Foundation, they give a lot of money to Columbia, which runs the Pulitzers, and they're rewarded for it. I mean, we had one case when I was at the paper where John Burns had been reporting from Afghanistan. He wasn't on the short list, and they you know, the Times was upset, and they magically produced a new short list, and he won. I mean, yeah, they had their hands in it. It's not a. Maybe it's been cleaned up, but it wasn't cleaned up when I was there.
Could we get to Days of Destruction and Days of Revolt? Days of Destruction was written before the election. Could you give us your observations about why you wrote that? What compelled you to write that? And did what followed, which means the election of Donald Trump as president, did you presage that? Did you predict that in your book, do you think?
I think I've predicted it in all of my books, that the cost of deindustrialization and the crippling economic assault that has been carried out on the working class and the middle class would destroy our democracy. I think that goes back to American Fascist, Death of the Liberal Class, all of these books, and that there are deep political consequences, as I saw in places like Yugoslavia, that when a market economy ceases to function for most of its citizens, you vomit up these buffoonish and frightening figures like Slobodan Milosevic or Radovan Karadzic or Donald Trump. That's been a consistent theme in my work, and unfortunately we have now reached that point.
What do you think will happen when Donald Trump doesn't realize that he runs the country? You know, when I interviewed Garrison, this was back in 1981, and I asked him if he thought the president ran the country. It's a funny thing. He was drinking a glass of water at the time, and he almost spit it out, and he chuckled, and he said, well, I did before they murdered John Kennedy. And you saw just before the Electoral College finally gave Trump the presidency that the CIA was openly using congressional assets to try to disrupt the congressional the college and deny him the vote. What do you think is really going to happen?
I don't think he cares. I think he's a con artist. I think he doesn't stand for much. The deep state, right? The president essentially acts as a kind of brand for these forces. I don't think he's going to be that engaged, I'm guessing. But you're right. There are, and Sheldon Wolin has written about this in Democracy Incorporated, we've undergone a kind of corporate coup d'etat. You can't defy the interests of Goldman Sachs, as we are seeing now with, it doesn't matter whether it's Clinton or Trump or whoever it is, and you can't defy the war industry, Raytheon and Halliburton. There's nobody can touch the security and surveillance state. These are the real engines of power, and there's very little the executive branch can do to affect them.
The three really, really intensely interesting things to me about your book, Unspeakable, which I'll read again. First of all, is reading about your childhood and what formed you. Secondly, your opinions about some very prominent intellectuals and writers in the country. But to me, I think one of the most interesting things is what brings about the collapse of fake regimes, the collapse of dictatorial regimes. And it's not necessarily, as you say, an armed incursion or revolt. It's this integration from within when those who protect the owners decide that they don't want to protect them anymore. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, that's always been the case. Even back to the Russian Revolution, when they sent the Cossacks in to crush the bread riots in Petrograd, and they refused. The Tsar was finished. I mean, the Tsar rushed back from the front. He had to abdicate in a railway carriage. That was true in East Germany. I covered the fall of East Germany. So the communist dictator Erich Honecker sent down an elite paratroop division to Leipzig because they had about 70,000 people in the streets, and they wouldn't fire on the crowd. Honecker was out within a week. That was true in Czechoslovakia, the next revolution I covered. That was true in Romania, where the very general who Ceausescu had appointed to impose martial law oversaw his, you know, kangaroo court or show trial. It was held very quickly, and his execution. So that's always the case. It's when a decrepit regime that has lost its credibility can't rely on the foot soldiers, the bureaucratic elites, the police, and to defend themselves, they're done. And the great theorists of revolution, Crane Brinton and Davies and Jeffrey Davies and others, have all pointed it out, that no revolution succeeds until a significant portion of the security apparatus defects. That was true in the Iranian Revolution when the Shah left the country, and a day or two later the head of the armed forces said they would no longer defend the regime. Then it's over. It was true also with Somoza. I mean, on and on and on.
Hey, do you think that Snowden's defection is a sign of that atrophy amongst the people?
Very astute. Yeah. I mean, I think you are seeing within the internal mechanisms of the elite an understanding that that things are seriously wrong, that this is essentially a government no longer concerned with the rights or even the needs of the citizenry, but of these corporate oligarchs.
What we we can see today, even people who didn't vote for Clinton or Trump, they can see from what has happened in this election that the American media is totally infested and corrupt. And it's been corrupt since right. the creation of Project Mockingbird, and it continues. So how does such disintegration begin? When do you think it would begin in this country? I mean, we got close to it in the Depression, and FDR saved capitalism with Social Security and with the rebuilding of the infrastructure in the United States. And of course, that didn't really work. They were eventually saved capitalism by the Second World War. So how do you see it playing out? What do you think would have to happen in order for such a real people's revolt to take place in this country, or will it never take place?
Well, you never can predict, but usually these things are precipitated by a crisis, and usually an economic crisis. So in Yugoslavia, for instance, you had an economic meltdown, hyperinflation, as you did in Weimar Germany, and I think, you know, a serious economic dislocation, which we may very well undergo. But I think you need a crisis of that magnitude in which, and especially when your currency is worth nothing.
Could we talk about a couple of the interesting personalities that you mention in your book? The first one that comes to mind is someone whose books I read a lot and admired. He was a loudmouth, but he was a literate loudmouth, and I guess you know I'm talking about Christopher Hitchens. He wrote a really interesting book about why Henry Kissinger, in helping to murder Allende in Chile, was a war criminal, and then turns around and defends probably the worst war criminal of the last 100 years in our country, George Bush, over Iraq. I could not understand it. Tell me about Christopher Hitchens.
Well, I think he was always a contrarian, always a bully. And I look at that 9/11, and I think it was fear. And I think he wanted the American empire to wipe these people out. I knew him, obviously. I really saw no real moral core there. He could be very cruel, as he was to it was his friend, remain my friend, Edward Said. Yeah, I think that these kind of showmen, these kind of ideologues, it's very easy to switch. I mean, it's very easy to go from the extreme left to the extreme right. You just change a few words and a little bit of the iconography, but it's the same kind of binary vision of the world of us against them. I mean, that's why, for instance, let's go back to the Nazis, Hitler would only recruit from the Communist Party because it was the same kind of rigid ideology, and I think Hitchens had that.
Who, to you, are your most inspiring writers? Name two or three.
James Baldwin, George Orwell, Dwight MacDonald. You're talking about essays. Those would be political essays.
You know, when James Baldwin wrote The Fire Next Time, he was arrested in New Orleans in the 60s, and Jim Garrison refused to bring charges against him because of the First Amendment, and the city was extremely upset at him, but he still won election as district attorney. Could I now ask you about Noam Chomsky?
I admire Noam tremendously. And I think all intellectuals owe a tremendous debt to Chomsky. I wrote a book called Death of the Liberal Class, and I told Noam I probably should have put him down as a co-author, since he's the one who really provided the most insightful, to me, window into what a liberal class does in a capitalist democracy, what its function is, how it works. Chomsky, yes. Chomsky's somebody. I mean, I think he's probably America's greatest living intellectual.
I had Mike Gravel on about 3 months ago, and he mentioned the exact same thing. Do you mind, and I hope you don't get upset at me, do you mind if I mention something about Noam Chomsky that truly bothers me? And I have all of his books. When he writes about foreign policy, he is dead on. When he writes about Israel, he is dead on. But I just finished doing part two of the Garrison tapes, and it's American media in the second assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And it is just an amazing, amazing indictment of the American media. Some assisted the CIA in the murder of John Kennedy, and all of them protected the murderers afterward. And we name names, and you see it. Noam Chomsky is an expert on foreign policy. The greatest foreign policy disaster, I would have to ask you, do you think it was the Vietnam War? John Kennedy was withdrawing. There were 12,000 advisors there. He was withdrawing 1,000 a month. He said so on CBS to Walter Cronkite just days before he was murdered. And Noam Chomsky, that resulted in that foreign policy disaster based on the fake Bay of Tonkin resolution. Now, we have Chomsky on camera at a seminar saying, who cares about who killed John Kennedy? It doesn't matter. That is appalling to me. Now, when Oliver Stone makes JFK, it becomes such an enormous hit and brings up the subject of the assassination again, which I'm glad David Talbot mentions a few times in your book, Unspeakable. And what happens is Congress is forced to pass the Assassination Records Act. They release documents written in 1967, and the CIA admits it. They have to help play Shaw, otherwise Garrison's going to get a conviction. And what happens after that is Noam Chomsky comes out and writes a book. The title is so long, I can't remember. It's a long title, very short on facts, in which he deliberately denigrates John Kennedy as a warmongering president and not a peace-seeking president, which all memoranda and all film refute. Now, that to me, there's something fishy. Let me add this. He makes $500,000 a year going around attacking the American government's foreign policy. Phil Donahue, on one day, attacks George Bush on the most highly rated show on MSNBC over the fake weapons of mass destruction, and the lady president fires him, saying, quote, he didn't wave the flag enough. So my getting this out of my system to somebody, the man and the writer I respect the most in America, I just would like your reading on that.
Well, I haven't read that book by Noam. He's written 100 books. I haven't read all of Noam's books. So I can't go after a book I haven't read. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know that this was Noam's position until you raised it. If he said, we don't care who killed, I wouldn't agree with him, obviously. I mean, he's flawed like the rest of us. But in terms of his dissection of, as you correctly point out, empire and how it works, he has very, very, he probably has no rivals. This is just an aspect of Noam I don't know anything about. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know till you mentioned it tonight.
As a matter of fact, when the documentary comes out, I will indeed send you a copy. I sent you a copy of The Last Word on the Assassination last time you heard. Chris, I would love to take a break right now. When we come back, you, to me, truly are the brightest man in America. But I think one of the very best journalists, his name is Joe Satilli, he puts out by far the best daily newsletter, the most objective, the most well-chosen newsletter I've ever seen. It's called News Vandal. He is a regular on my show. He is my second favorite American beside you. And I'm going to take a break right now. We have to take a little break. And I'd like to bring him back and let him talk to you and you talk to him, because you'll be in great company. Thanks so much. We'll be right back with Joe Satilli and Chris Hedges.
Great music. All the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing
at last?
Well, beyond the sea.
Then, great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs. conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders, a tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Valzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Thank you, and welcome back to John Barber's World here in Las Vegas. We're speaking with the incomparable Chris Hedges, who has a fantastic semi-autobiographical book called Unspeakable. It's a conversation between him and David Daubert, the brilliant author of The Devil's Chessboard about Alan Dulles. And we're going to be joined right now with my second favorite American, Joe Satilli, who is a regular on my show. Joe, welcome to the show. Happy holidays. And can I ask Chris one quick question? How many children do you have? And in your book, I read this wonderful story about your son writing an article about the college he was at with their denial of the rape culture that existed, which cost him his job with the local newspaper. Tell me about your son, what he's doing now, and how many children you have and what they're doing.
Well, I have four. Three of them are still in school. He's out. He finished college and but he did. He's a very fine athlete, and heard stories in the locker room from the fraternities about hazing and date rape, and ended up writing an investigative piece for the paper, which angered the alumni from the fraternity system, and he ended up getting banned from the paper, and the administration tried to cover it up, and now he's working as a journalist for the Real News in Baltimore.
Oh, that's wonderful. Good for him. Joe, how are you? Did you have a happy holiday and welcome to the show?
Well, sure, I had a happy holiday. Good to be with you, John, and good to be with you, Chris. It was 1987 that I was able to sit down with you for about an hour and 25 minutes in Washington, D.C. for my film, The Warning. Thank you for that. That was a great conversation. And my question to you is this. I've been working as a journalist for many, many years. I find that I have a great deal of freedom because I'm poor because I have poverty. And there seems to be a direct relationship between poverty and freedom to actually cover stories. It also means that I don't have the resources to go out and cover stories that I would like to go cover because you are also limited. The reason I'm setting it up this way is my question is to you, somebody who is has a great demonstrable track record as a journalist, in this weird matrix of disinformation, corporate control of the media, and now this fake news crisis, as real or as fake as the fake news crisis may be, what is it that journalists can do to get usable information to people who seem to vote and act against their own self-interest politically?
Well, it's very hard. You know, I don't own a TV. I only see it when I'm at the gym. But I watched the evening news tonight, and it was David Axelrod, hired by CNN to interview Barack Obama. Yeah. This is insane. As if David Axelrod is a journalist. Of course, he was one of Obama's chief aides for many years. So that was just a small window, and now utterly incestuous and ridiculous.
It's Mortimer Snerd interviewing Edgar Bergen.
Yeah, and so I find the withering away of the media, and particularly the commercial electronic media, quite frightening. Of course, newspapers are in free fall because they no longer can get the advertising. They don't have that monopoly connecting sellers with buyers that they used to have. And so journalism becomes more and more obsequious in an attempt to cater to a diminishing market. And people who want to do real journalism, which has kind of always been the case in America, you're right, are pushed so far to the margins, they have a hard time finding a platform and they can't make a living. And I find it very, very frightening. And you do need resources, especially for investigative journalism. I covered Al-Qaeda for the New York Times after 9/11, based in Paris. And it was, just in expenses alone, well over $100,000, and that didn't even include my salary and everything else. So you're right that especially to do an investigative piece, it requires resources, and that's the first thing that most regional papers have cut. We have almost no investigative reporting anymore.
There is a great deal of despair amongst the people who have voted on one side or the other about the other side in this country, and let's just go from what would be generally the liberal, the left side, this idea that the people that voted for Donald Trump are operating in a post-truth reality, in a factless world. Do you have a fundamental feeling of hope or trust in the American people that actually the only thing that's really missing is that they are in a media environment that is so vacuous and so free of tangible facts and information? For example, I can turn on the BBC and I can see news reports from 10 countries in 15 minutes. You can actually see what poverty looks like in sub-Saharan Africa if you watch enough BBC. You will never see that if you watch the evening news in the United States. So is it really, if we could just get pictures through to these people, if we could just get information through to the American people, that the American people intrinsically would actually begin to operate and vote and demand different things?
Yeah, it's part of a broader, you're right to pick that up. Pictures without context don't really do much. I think we also have to acknowledge how skillfully news is managed by the public relations industry, publicists, communications departments, political personalities like Clinton are created. They're fictitious personalities. So news is so controlled and managed. And then, of course, it's all because it's not like the old newspaper empires, like the Hearst Empire. Now you're part of Viacom, so you're one of news as a revenue stream that has to compete with other revenue streams. And if you don't produce, then they don't care what you put on. You just have to make money. That's what's been so corrosive, I think, to the news industry. We also have to acknowledge that the public, you know, the American education system at one point was one of the jewels of the world, the public education system. It's been destroyed. The people don't have a civic education. They don't even have much of an education in many parts of the country. And I think that the collapse of the media, coupled with the collapse of education, has, and the cynicism on the part of the news industry itself, where you have a news personality. Remember, these people make millions of dollars. These people couldn't report their way out of a paper bag, but they make millions of dollars posing as journalists, and they have one lying pundit or party operative from the Republicans and another lying pundit or party operative from the Democrats, and they give them equal time to lie, and they never call them out. I find it very cynical on their part, even when they know that they're being disingenuous, and that's called balance. I find the collapse of the media truly terrifying, but it is also accompanied by the collapse of public education and a widespread kind of illiteracy, which contributes to that as well.
When we talked about what in 1987 for the warning, what we were both talking about at that time was the possibility that America was on a tipping point of fascism. And one of the things that you were talking about at that time was the role that America's peculiar form of Christianity was playing in the political milieu that was generating the possibility of a fascist outcome. And I'm curious as to your assessment of the interesting interplay between Donald Trump and the evangelicals and what that means for that form of American Christianity and American culture and life.
Right. Well, he got 81% of the evangelical vote. And as a seminary graduate, I don't consider them Christians. I consider them heretics. And the failure of the liberal church is it didn't call them out as heretics. They fused the iconography and language of American patriotism or nationalism with the iconography and language of Christianity, which is just what the pro-Nazi German Christian church did under Hitler. Jesus did not come to make us rich. Jesus would not bless the dropping of iron fragmentation bombs all over the Middle East. And the liberal church remained mute and silent. And what we will see, especially with Pence, is the assertion of this religious chauvinism and bigotry, especially to people considered non-believers, Muslims and others, but also people they call nominal Christians, people like myself. We will see an accelerated attack on the GBLT community. We will see an accelerated assault against women's rights. This will be the kind of license that I think a Trump administration will hand to this group, which we saw demographically was certainly one of his largest and most fervent base. You know, it constituted one of his most important kind of electoral successes within the last election.
Do you in any way see a congealing of the rise of the Orthodox Church inside Russia under Putin and this form of evangelical fundamentalism coming together in some kind of cooperative anti-Islam global alliance that could really do a great deal of damage and essentially be the official start of World War III? I mean, am I overselling this?
I don't know enough about the Orthodox Church in Russia to answer that question. But I think it's a legitimate question because the Christian right in this country, they are our homegrown jihadists. And the whole concept of holy war is part of the Christian tradition, just as it is also part of Islam.
Right.
It's not a tradition that I embrace, but it exists. And yes, I think that we could see a kind of perverted alliance between various Christian forces. to essentially declare war against Islam. I mean, the Christian right in this country has already pretty much done that.
Well, you know, we've gotten to this point where you have mass migration, and obviously Western liberalism is in crisis. And I'm wondering to what extent you feel or you sense that really where we are is at a crisis in Western civilization as a project, insofar as it has attached itself to consumer capitalism. And maybe it just may be, you know, the head of IKEA said last summer, maybe we've reached peak stuff. Is it just possible that this has all run its course and there is such a crisis of values that basically we are stumbling around in the dark looking for some sort of meaning and unable to find something to hold on to?
Well, great question. Precisely, that's what's happened. 500 years of rape, pillage, looting, colonialism, conquest, genocide, the game is up. And our inability to deal with it, both intellectually and morally, is creating, you know, these very frightening figures that are rising up out of the swamp.
Chris, let me just interrupt just here for a second, because it brings back something that Joe said about people being informed. It is just at this point, people sense in their gut that something is wrong, something is remiss with the past 500 years of Western civilization, capitalism, and consumerism. However, nothing happens unless they're informed about it, and the sad, sad thing is even less happens unless there is a leader, someone they can follow to take them to the promised land, as Martin Luther King said. But what the owners of the country do is they murder the shepherds of the sheep. So how we have this feeling, we sense it in our gut, but how are we going to, we all live behind our computers and our cell phones. We have no more social congregation anymore. It's all disappeared. How do we get together to make a movement? Because you believe in movements.
Well, you've seen it. I was just out at Standing Rock. You had it there. You saw it in Occupy. And they weren't, but you're right. Sitting behind your computer, quote unquote, doing activism is just where they want you to be, alone in your room with your computer. So, you're very right. But we are seeing those movements. But remember how brutally, especially in Standing Rock, the response has been rubber bullets, concussion grenades, CS gas. These are unarmed, nonviolent protesters. So we have seen these nascent movements, and we've seen a very harsh state repression. But you're right. I mean, this is by design. The whole charter school system is the next assault against public education. It's all about vocational training. If you live in a marginal community, you're going to be given enough literacy and numerical literacy to work at a Burger King. And if you go to Princeton, you'll be given enough literacy to work for Goldman Sachs.
The Vietnam War ended because in the 60s, the entire country became Standing Rock, and that's because middle-class boys were being murdered in this fake war in Vietnam.
Right.
The rulers are really smart. They knew they were not going to have a draft, but they needed somebody to fight. So how did they get soldiers? They dumb them down so they can't get a job. They export jobs out of the country with Clinton signing NAFTA, the worst president in American history. I know three kids who are honor students are joining the military because they can't get a job.
Right.
They might be killing people in a few years. They might become hired guns.
Right. No, that's – I would totally agree with you on Clinton. He probably did even more damage than Ronald Reagan. Sure. I mean, you don't want a population informed and educated. It's why slaves who were found to be able to read were killed by slaveholders. And it's very much the same. They want us to be entranced by these electronic hallucinations. I mean, what was on the evening news tonight? It was Carrie Fisher recovering from her heart attack, and George Michael, who was a pretty bad singer, as far as I can tell, this was the national news. I mean, it's nuts. And David Axelrod interviewing the president. I mean, it's burlesque. And the corporate state couldn't be happier.
I love that moment in your book, Unspeakable, when you talked about Saturday Night Live and that girl who did the impression of Hillary. Go ahead, tell us what the character said on Saturday Night Live.
I don't remember what.
I wish I could find the page. Anyway, the character does all these, it says all these different things that she hasn't said for 20 years. And then she finally looks at the audience and says, "Oh, be whatever you want me to be."
Right, I'll be whatever. That's right. I'll be whatever. This is the one where she tries to morph into Bernie Sanders. Well, you know, that's Barack Obama, too. I mean, that's all of them.
And a year and a half ago, I hate to say it, but I predicted that Bernie Sanders would be the Democrats' Ron Paul. He'd give us all fake hope, and then he would disappear. And I know you've had conversations with Bernie, and I think he was probably stunned that he got 12 million votes, and he had more millennials than all the rest of them put together. Yeah. All the young people, young people never knew America when it had this hope. Then it was Jimmy Stewart and Frank Capra. But somehow or other, as I said earlier, they sense something needs to be done, and I hate to use the word spiritual, but on a spiritual level to just somehow make this country right again. Anyway, I want to thank the both of you so much. You know, the great thing about having a talk show, Joe and Chris, is it can become a wonderful listening show. And I sat here for the last 15 minutes just enthralled listening to you two. Chris, your book is called The Unspeakable. Where can folks go to get it? And I urge them to go.
Any independent bookstore, go to Powell's online. That's an independent bookstore out of Portland, Oregon.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful new year. I hope you come back after the first of the year. Joe,
right.
And where can they find you?
Just go to newsvandal.com, and you can sign up for the News Vandal Rundown 5 days a week, probably the best aggregated newsletter in America, if I do say so myself.
Well, I've said it every time I introduce you. It is by far the best written, best researched, most objective newsletter in the entire country. And congratulations, Joe. I want to thank Doug, our engineer, Mike, my producer, and as Ed Murray used to say, good night, good luck, and have a happy new year. We'll talk to you in January, Joe and I will. Bye-bye.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 sunny.